Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Come gather around, people, wherever you roam, and admit that the waters around you have grown, and accept it that soon you'll be drenched to the bone. If your time to you is worth saving, then you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone. For the times, they are a-changing.
Bob Dylan, the New York Dolls, Chet Baker, and Warren Zevon all had one thing, one person, in common. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today, Paul Nelson was an early supporter of all these stars and many others. We'll look back at one of music's forgotten figures. And we'll look ahead to the burgeoning career of jazz pianist Gerald Clayton. When Paul Nelson died in 2006, few people realized how much music history died with him. An influential figure in the recording world, he became a leading music critic, and later still, walked away from it all and disappeared from view. Recently, though, he was the inspiration for a fictional character in Jonathan Lethem's new book, Chronic City, and the subject of an exhaustive upcoming biography by Kevin Avery. Both writers join us today to discuss the life and death and the legacy of Paul Nelson. Jonathan, let me start with you because, in all honesty, this was your idea. I was one of those people who didn't understand what it meant when Paul Nelson died. So who was he? Why is he so important?
Well, you know, Kevin's going to be better equipped to kind of place him historically. I knew Paul pretty well for a short, very, very important period. And then passingly after that, I would see him coming and going from New York in the years when I was away. But Paul, you know, when I met him, was very reticent about talking about his accomplishments and his legacy. But he'd been involved in the careers of so many incredible musicians. And you know, as an A&R guy,
artist and repertoire,
he'd, well, essentially, you know, revived the Velvet Underground's career by putting together that two-record set of live recordings, mm-hmm. the Green.
It's just called Velvet Underground 1969.
1969, yeah.
Right.
And
when did you meet? When's this period that you knew him?
Well, I ran into Paul. It would have been 85, I think, when I was first kind of dropping out of college and coming back to New York. I was hanging out a lot at a bookstore on the Upper East Side, a little used bookstore run by my still dear friend Michael Seidenberg, and Paul was kind of haunting the bookshop. So he and I were there together, kind of pawing through the marvelous old volumes and talking with Michael. And you know, Paul was very, very reticent, kind of quiet guy, but we would slowly discover these things that he'd, you know, known Dylan in college, and that he'd written a defense of his Going Electric that was, you know, a kind of a watershed moment in the argument over folk versus rock in Dylan's career. And then he'd say, you know, oh yeah, well, I worked with, you know, with Lester Bangs. I wrote a couple of books with Lester Bangs, when we were sort of, our jaws would drop. And he was at that point just this kind of very, very well, fairly depressed guy who didn't hear a lot in the current music that he liked. Mostly, he was collecting Chet Baker CDs and telling us that if he wrote anything ever again, he'd want to write a biography of Chet Baker. And you know, but one by one, these incredible stories would emerge. And he was also a great, great film buff, and turned me on personally to, you know, most of the great Hollywood directors that I've come to love. Back at a time when, you know, you didn't have the Criterion Collection, you didn't have TCM. So
why base a character on him? I mean, it sounds like there was this process of drawing a character out of him.
Yeah, well, you know, it's very deceptive in a way to suggest that this character in Chronic City is based on Paul, because no one who knew Paul would recognize this guy. My character's flamboyant and smokes a lot of pot and is kind of a dandy and very argumentative. Paul was the opposite of all those things. But what I drew from Paul for inspiration was this kind of cultural obsession, to the point where it was as though Paul, and my character is depicted in the same way, was living on whatever he cared about, as if, you know, Chet Baker CDs were food and oxygen. And at the time I knew Paul, there were five or six key obsessions: Ross McDonald, Chet Baker, and you know, he was very, very into Philip K. Dick, which we had that in common, and you know, Orson Welles. And he cherished these things, and he'd talk about them, and he'd present them as if they were the kind of key to understanding the entire universe. And that was what I wanted to depict in the book.
The book is Chronic City by my guest Jonathan Latham. Kevin Avery is the author of Everything is an Afterthought, The Life and Writings of Paul Nelson. So, Kevin, you've got Jonathan has the fictional guy. You have the real thing. Why is he still worth coming back to in 2009, many years after he had taken himself off the scene?
The main reason is he's just an excellent writer. I first discovered Paul's work in the 70s when I was a teenager and living in Salt Lake City, and read his work in Rolling Stone, and there was just something about his words, the way he put them together, but also the way he would describe the music. He would use literature and film and all of these other points to describe the music he was talking about. And it was almost like he was taking you into his confidence. You know, he's like, here, I've got something you need to hear. Mm. And so over the years, I just, you know, from the 70s till the early 80s when he disappeared, I read everything he wrote and I collected him.
What about, Jonathan mentions he was one of the first people to stand up for Bob Dylan.
Yes.
When Dylan went electric. We started with Dylan not out of happenstance, because that seems to be how he got started as well.
Yeah, when Paul was attending the University of Minnesota in 1959, Robert Zimmerman was attending at the same time as well. And he and Paul got to know each other. At the time, Paul and one of his schoolmates, John Pancake, published a small little journal called the Little Sandy Review, which basically wrote about folk music. Mm-hmm. Seriously. And it came to Dylan's attention. And so Paul and Dylan eventually got together.
So when Robert Zimmerman becomes Bob Dylan and moves to New York, how soon after that does Paul Nelson make the same trip to
New York? Not very long after, yeah.
And his little fanzine becomes sort of an important part of that whole Greenwich Village folk revival.
It is. The Little Sandy Review started in 1960, and Paul moved back here in 1963. And Little Sandy Review kind of petered out because Paul came back here to accept the position as managing editor at Sing Out magazine, and he just didn't have time to do it anymore. Mm-hmm.
What about the idea that, you know, Jonathan, we're talking about a guy who might have been, you know, living, as you say, on his obsessions, but they're obsessions from long ago. I mean, are we romanticizing a guy who's... Is this just more boomer nostalgia? We're no longer content with being nostalgic for the music. Now we're nostalgic for the people who wrote about it as well.
Well, I mean, Kevin's right that Paul's a sublime writer and worth reading. You know, I can look at those old issues of Little Sandy Review and read festival reports where he's basically sitting and watching a bunch of acts get on and off stage, most of whom... You know, they not only are has-beens, they never were. It was just a local folk festival with a couple of notable performances, but Paul brings the entire thing to life, and he does so in a way that projects a conversation. What's so amazing, I mean, Kevin describes him as intimate. What's so amazing about Paul's early writing is that he's asserting that this stuff is worth talking about, that there is a standard of value that everyone can grasp if they care to. And, you know, along with Paul Williams and Crawdaddy and I guess Greg Shaw and Bomp, this is the invention of something. To talk seriously, as you do every day on the radio, about popular music, that's not a given.
Right.
At mid-century, no one would have considered this stuff anything but ephemeral or sort of beneath, you know, the dignity of critical language. It wasn't worth doing. And so Paul's an inventor of part of our culture in that sense.
How did he get from, Kevin, from Dylan and Sing Out magazine and the folk revival to signing the New York Dolls, the proto-punk, proto-glam band?
Well, after Paul resigned from Sing Out, when Dylan went electric, he freelanced for a while. And when 1970 rolled around, somebody offered him a job in A&R at Mercury Records. And he spent the first year and a half in publicity, and then transitioned over into A&R, and one of the groups that came to his attention was the New York Dolls, and that was the genius of Paul, that amidst all this noise, at the heart of it, Paul was really a word guy. He loved lyrics, and he recognized the genius of the New York Dolls. But it was a big uphill battle convincing his higher-ups to sign them.
Paul Nelson signed this band, and now authors Jonathan Lethem and Kevin Avery are here remembering the man who signed the band. The group is the New York Dolls. Personality Crisis, early hits for the New York Dolls, a group that was unleashed on an unsuspecting and, at the time, largely unimpressed music world by Paul Nelson, the critic and writer that we're discussing today on Soundcheck, with his biographer, Kevin Avery, and with the novelist, Jonathan Lethem, whose new book, Chronic City, has a character based on or inspired by Paul Nelson. Kevin, he signed the band, and in retrospect, you know, a guy signing the New York Dolls and putting together, as Jonathan mentioned before, the pivotal 2-LP compilation of Velvet Underground tracks, he seems, in 2020 hindsight, like a musical genius. How did these decisions go over back in the day?
Well, he claimed that signing the Dolls was his demise.
Kevin, didn't he also try to sign the original Modern Lovers?
Yes.
Jonathan Richman?
Yeah. I mean, that would have completed the trifecta there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. And he just he had an eye and an ear, obviously, for these groups that were outside of the norm, the norm of that day.
But somebody at least had an idea that this guy might have been onto something, because while he was still at Mercury Records, Rod Stewart would apparently seek him out, ask his advice. Well, what was that relationship?
Yeah, Rod and Paul became very good pals, and Paul actually went on a couple of tours with Rod. And
as what? Tour manager or
something? No, just part of A&R and publicity. And but more than anything, Rod got to the point where he really relied on Paul's recommendations. Paul recommended a couple obscure Dylan tunes that Rod Stewart ultimately covered. And before Rod would actually play his new albums to the Mercury Brass, he would ask Paul to give him a listen first. And Paul would give his suggestions.
And we're talking about early Rod Stewart, you know,
right.
Pre-disco, pre-American songbook Rod Stewart.
Yes.
Around the time of this album, in fact, called Every Picture Tells a Story. I'm moving right out of here, yeah. On the Peking Ferry, I was feeling merry. Sailing on my way back here, I fell in love with a slit-eyed lady. By the light of an eastern moon, Shanghai Lil never used a pill. She claimed that. Rod Stewart was doing some great work back in the early 70s. Kevin Avery, it was Paul Nelson who he seemed to rely on for a lot of advice and things like that during this time.
Absolutely.
And after Paul Nelson leaves Mercury Records and begins his career with Rolling Stone, you know, becomes a leading reviewer and editor and music critic, Does the relationship change? What happens?
Probably the key thing that happened is Paul was assigned to write a Rolling Stone feature story about Rod. This was in 1978. And Rod didn't like some of the things that Paul had written. And it was a very confessional piece. All of Paul's pieces, his best pieces, are very autobiographical. And he's very much a part of the story, and he sets it up by, you know, telling about what his relationship with Rod was. But at the same time, he acknowledges the changes that he's seeing, you know, take place in Rod's music, and you know, this
and
is
wardrobe
and wardrobe and you know, to use a phrase, he'd gone Hollywood, and you know, as after the article came out, Paul's calls were not returned.
And then he and Lester Bangs write this book that really just savages Rod Stewart. You got a chance to interview Rod Stewart for the upcoming biography.
Right.
Is he bitter, or does he view it as water under the bridge?
Well, you know, one of the he takes a pretty broad-minded view of the whole thing. I read him a passage of what Paul had written. And Paul had written something to the effect that, you know, Rod Stewart had gone from a guy who in his songs imparted wisdom worthy of our grandfathers, had thrown it all away. And Rod admitted that was probably true. And in a rare confessional moment, said, "I probably needed guys like Rod or like Paul and Lester Bangs to kick me up the arse," as he would say.
We're talking about the late music critic Paul Nelson with the novelist Jonathan Lethem and with his biographer Kevin Avery, whose bio comes out next fall. And in a moment, more of our conversation. And then later on the show, the new album from Gerald Clayton marks the jazz pianist and composer's debut as a band leader. He'll join us with his trio to play live here in our Soundcheck studio.
Check out today's Soundcheck blog.
It's hard to imagine in a world where everyone's a critic how a couple of critics could stand out the way they used to in the LP era. But I wonder if that's healthier. Maybe having three or four critics wielding that much influence is a restrictive thing.
For the rest of the story, visit the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org.
Won't you spare me over till another year? Well, what is this that I can't see with ice cold hands taking hold of me? Well, I am death, none can excel. I'll open the door to heaven or hell.
This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. We're talking about the life and work of the late Paul Nelson. He was an early champion of Bob Dylan and Jackson Browne, and a very late champion of this bluegrass singer, the legendary Ralph Stanley. Novelist Jonathan Lethem has a fictional character based on Paul Nelson inhabiting his latest work, Chronic City. And writer Kevin Avery has the real Paul Nelson front and center in his forthcoming biography. Jonathan, the character of Purkus Tooth, first of all, a very Dickensian name there. Are we supposed to gather anything of his personality just from his name?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, right. Maybe Tooth is Tooth Bites. But, you know, I was thinking about Paul as Kevin was telling the stories about Rod Stewart, and you were talking about the Lester Bangs book, which was a kind of act of inadvertent revenge in a way. But I think, if I'm right, Kevin, that, I mean, Paul used to tell the story that the way they wrote that book was that it was Lester had been commissioned to do something, and he couldn't write a book. and Paul offered to help him. And so Paul sat and I believe he described them sitting on a rooftop in the summer at night. And Paul sat at the typewriter, and Lester drank cough syrup and just walked circles around the typewriter dictating. And Paul was just typing as fast as he could and you know, then amplifying. And but it was Lester's book initially, and that generosity is very typical of Paul, that selflessness. He really didn't mean to write that book. He wanted to help Lester write his.
Hmm. But your character is an oddball.
Yes. Well, what I took from Paul in creating my character was the power of his influence. The way Perkis affects the narrative of the book is the way Paul affected me. In those years in my early 20s when I was sort of at his side absorbing whatever his newest obsessions happened to be. And, you know, through him I began to see how much you could make out of devouring American culture and, you know, and vernacular culture, that Howard Hawks films or you know, Chandler and Ross McDonald, you know, not to mention the Velvet Underground or mm-hmm. or
would he mention them, or was he really just all about writers and film?
He was very focused on whatever was in front of him, and when I knew him, he was a slightly disenchanted listener. He didn't feel there was anything new that he could respond to, and his relationship with Dylan was in decline. You know, there was a long time after that sort of Pledge of Allegiance he recited by going electric as a writer, you know, and resigning from Sing Out, where Dylan trusted him so implicitly that, much like Rod Stewart, I think Dylan sent him every new record and would call him and say, you know, what do you think of this? But these relationships were in decline. Paul had slipped away from the community of you know, music writers at Rolling Stone. He was always a retiring mm-hmm. personality in a field dominated by a lot of very brash, you know, not just Lester Bangs, but, you know, brilliant career makers like you know, Chris Gow, the Dean, mm-hmm. or Greil Marcus. And Paul had none of that instinct. He was just content to write about what he cared about. But privately, his obsessions were his whole life. And for me, it was mostly film. We would talk about, you know, early Westerns and film noir.
And when you knew him, was he was working at a film store, right?
Well, actually, in that period, his day job, it's so strange for, you know, someone who's truly an important American writer. He was a copy editor at
a Jewish Weekly.
Yeah. Yeah, and no one there knew who Paul Nelson was. It was just a place to go and work at a desk. And then later he ended up working behind the counter of a video shop for a long time on Bleecker Street.
Carmine, excuse me.
Yeah.
Kevin, in putting the biography together called Everything is an Afterthought, coming out next fall, it almost sounds like a Rashomon kind of thing, you know, where some people knew this part of Paul Nelson, some people knew that part of Paul Nelson. Did anybody really know the whole person?
No, I don't think so. And in the course of doing the interviews, which I ended up doing about 100, everybody had, you know, their own little take on it, but occasionally they would overlap, and you would kind of see where the pieces started to fit together.
And do they fit together, or do you end up with, you know, these apparently disparate things?
No, I think they do fit together, and I think Jonathan touched on it. Paul became disenchanted with the music in the mid-'80s, early 80s, and he really did walk away from the music. A lot of the artists that he had instilled a lot of hope in kind of, in his eyes, I think, let him down. I mean, and that was something that I did see in researching the book over and over again. Paul would invest so much of himself. He really did, like you said, he survived on this art, and ultimately it would let him down.
Jonathan, there is a great irony here that the person you had to drag these stories out of put so much of himself in some of his best writing, the big cover article on Warren Zevon, which is as much about Paul Nelson as it is about
absolutely.
Warren Zevon. By the end of his life, where was he throwing his obsession, his passion?
Well, Paul's fade was a very, very slow fade. Very hard to pull him out of himself at all in, I'd say, the whole last decade of his life. He was working on a screenplay, which may have been a borderline imaginary project. Anyway, it was a kind of phantom manuscript that no one saw. And, you know, he was in a way receding into his own romantic obsessions because they weren't going to let him down. And I think, you know, the fact that he turned to figures who were either, you know, gone, like Chet Baker, or their work was, you know, decades and decades old, like Ralph Stanley, or the fact that he was dwelling so much on film noir and Orson Welles, he'd chosen older figures who couldn't let him down. They weren't in process anymore. And, you know, it's as if he couldn't risk it all on some new piece of music or some new career.
So as he did at the very beginning of his life, coming back at the end to Chet Baker. And we're talking about Paul Nelson. He is the subject of the book called Everything is an Afterthought, The Life and Writings of Paul Nelson by his biographer, Kevin Avery. And you can find a link to Kevin's website on the Soundcheck page at WNYC.org. And the ghost of Paul Nelson stalks through Jonathan Lethem's new book called Chronic City in the character of Perkis Tooth. Jonathan, Kevin, thank you both for being with us on Soundcheck today.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And still to come, singer Diana Krall and trumpet player Roy Hargrove are just two of the artists who've enlisted the talents of Gerald Clayton. The jazz pianist and composer joins us with his own trio to play live next.
For love is all. Love was grand when love was new. Birds were singing, skies were blue. Now